Hi, everyone. I'm Kurt Brunner, your host, and thanks for listening. Those of you who are familiar with the book Steve Stroop and I wrote called It Starts at Home know that we talk about something called the likelihood principle. And the likelihood principle for parents is simply this. In the context of healthy relationships, children tend to adopt the beliefs and values of their parents. Now, there's no guarantees, but you dramatically increase the likelihood when you've got that solid, grace-filled relationship. And that's why I'm excited about what you're going to hear on today's episode. A friend of mine, Dr. Tim Kimmel, who is a fellow leader in this movement of churches who are trying to create a culture of intentional families. Now, Tim is the president of Family Matters. He's a best-selling author, and his primary emphasis is best articulated in a book he did called Grace-Based Parenting. And what we're about to hear are excerpts from a talk he gave that is specifically on that theme of how to build a strong relationship with your children so that it becomes more likely that they will want what we believe. Now, I should say before you begin listening to Tim that on the stage with him are a collection of plates, full-size plates, little mini plates, saucers that you might put bread on or something of that nature, and then kind of an oblong-shaped serving plate. And you'll understand why that's important to know in just a minute. So here's Dr. Tim Kimmel presenting Grace-Based Parenting.
Well, hi, everyone. Glad to be with you. And I love being teamed with this church because this church is deliberate about equipping families to take Jesus home. A strong church doesn't make strong families. Strong families make a strong church. I did marry back in 1972, but I fell in love with this girl a whole lot earlier than that. I met my wife in high school, and I was so smitten by her and her beauty and her wit and her charm and her brains. But it took me 5 years to convince her of all the untapped potential that was deeply embedded within me. I said, girl, I'm the mother lode of a great time. I mean, work with me. Marry me. You have no idea how much you can mine out of this person. It's not on the surface. Anyway, we married. And we went on our honeymoon to Dallas Theological Seminary. Honestly, we got married in Annapolis, Maryland, and we took right off across the way. And a week later, we were in school. We've had some children. In fact, we were married 8 years without children. That was not by design. We wanted to start our family pretty early, but we were told we couldn't conceive. And so we were adopting when we conceived our first and adopting when we conceived our second. We ended up conceiving four. Now, three of them are married, and we've entered into the holy of holies of grandparenting. And I can look out here and I can just tell some of you know the secret handshake. Grandparenting is God's reward for not selling your kids on Craigslist. I always noticed that grandparents and grandchildren seem to get along so much better with each other than those kids get along with their actual parents. And I figured that out why once I became a grandparent. The reason grandparents and grandchildren get along so well is they both share a common source of annoyance. And so it's just kind of your big chance to co-conspire to get even with a few things. Being family today is complicated. There's a lot coming at us, and we live in a very hurried world. It reminds me of the guy that used to spin plates. Maybe you've seen a guy at a circus, one of the clowns doing this, or somebody on television, or what they would take a plate and put it on a stick and they'd spin it, and they'd spin, and they'd keep adding plates. And of course, the first one or the third one, they're toppling, they're just running around like a crazy person spinning plates. Well, I think that's what it's like when we start off in our young adult, we're finishing up a degree program, we're starting our career, we got our friends, we got church, we might fall in love, get married, and we're just going crazy. But the cool thing is there's an app for this. And so you can get help on this thing, and we pick up a rhythm, and we think we're so clever, and then some of these come along. Children. And you know, you have your little saucers in between your plates, and these require a lot more velocity to keep them going smoothly, if you know what I mean. And so they're flying through there, and you got your hair on fire, and you don't know what to do, and then one of these comes along. This is a teenager. Not a saucer anymore. Not a plate yet either. Just thinks it's one. Wants all the privileges of a plate. but doesn't have any money. And it sure has a mind of its own when you try and put some spin on it, doesn't it? I mean, there was one time where of our four, we were three of them were platters at one time. And you should get combat pay for that. But when we started out as young parents, we thought, okay, we're only going to get one shot at this. Let's try and get it right. But as we looked around and we looked at the way we'd been raised ourselves, the parenting patterns we saw among the Christian community kind of gave us some concern. And we worked with young people too at that time. And here, let me just kind of rattle off some of the standard patterns of parenting that are prevalent among Christian families. Number one, the one I see the most is what I call fear-based parenting. And the parents are just so intimidated by what they're trying to do, and they're afraid of Hollywood, and they're afraid of hip-hop music, and they're afraid of Facebook, and they're afraid of texting, and they're afraid of public schools, and afraid of cohabitating neighbors, and so forth. Well, if our fears are driving our plan for parenting, they're going to form our strategy, and we're not going to like what we have waiting for us for all of our efforts. Because you see, if we're followers of Jesus, we should be the last people afraid of just about anything. Our God is sitting on a throne. He's not panicking at all. He nicknamed himself in the book of Revelation. When he said, John, write down this revelation. I'm the Alpha and the Omega. He picked the first and last letters of the Greek alphabet to say, it's basically saying, I'm the A to the Z. In other words, here's basically what he was saying. I'm the God who had the first word, and I'm the one who's going to have the last one. Do you trust me? And so a fear-based pattern does not work on a trust basis with God, so it makes its man-made things. Basically, when we let fears rule the way when us as parents, we basically invite God off the island. We kick him off the island. We try and do it on our own. It's a dead on arrival plan. And by the way, I'm not saying there isn't clear and present danger out there, but we wanted to raise kids that not only survived in a hostile world, they thrived in it. It actually made them stronger spiritually. So that one, then we saw a lot of sin management parenting going on, trying to keep their kids from sinning and trying to keep their kids from being exposed to sin. Well, that one's another dead on arrival plan because you give birth to sinners. That's what they do, and we live in a corrupted world. Unless you raise your kid in a hermetically sealed environment, which is a dumb idea, they're going to be exposed. That one wouldn't work. And then we saw a lot of evangelical behavioral modification, where we're just trying to constantly get them in line with what we think Christianity looks like, and along that same lines, image controlling. So we have this nice little list of what a nice Christian family looks like, and we try and jump through all the hoops. And what this all comes down to is basically performance-based Christianity. And why do we tend to put our kids on a performance base? Because we think we're on one with God. It's real easy to fall into this trap. And so with all that side, we thought, oh, there's got to be a better plan. And so we started studying the Bible early on as young parents. We said, Lord, we just know that it's not like you to give us all this responsibility for how a person ends up and not show us how to do this. And even though, but I'd never seen a theology on family or a theology on parenting. But sure enough, we found one. My wife she's the brains of the operation. And she made an interesting observation. Said, wait a minute, Tim, think about it. God's a parent. That's one of the things we call him, our Father who art in heaven. Jesus taught us to pray like that. We refer to him as our Heavenly Father. He's a parent. We're some of his kids. I wonder, and here was her question, I wonder if we could study him as a parent in the Bible, look at what he's doing and quantify it in such a way, you know, put some handles on it that could become our plan for raising our kids. And why do we call it grace-based? Because grace is the calling card of our God. He's the only God of grace in the universe. He's a God that's dealing with us, not according to our sin. He's a God who looks at us through his heart of grace. So if somebody handed me a napkin and said, what's your overarching seamless strategy for raising a Jesus follower that has a passion love for him? Here's what it looked like. I'd take a napkin out. I'd draw a house. And I would put at the top of it a one-sentence statement that summarizes grace-based parenting. It's simply, I want to treat my kids the same way God treats his kids, with grace. That's a one-sentence summary of grace-based family. Just treat your kids the way God treats you. There's no way I can unpack all this. I only have a few minutes left, but I want to walk you through four freedoms that we want to embed into our kids. We actually want to create in our homes that set hearts free. And the first freedom is that grace-based families give the people they love the freedom to be different. To be different. You say, well, that's fairly safe. How about I give you some synonyms for different so you know where I'm coming from? Weird. Bizarre. Strange, goofy, quirky. Grace-based homes have room for those kind of kids. Fear-based homes do not. Sin management homes do not. Image control families do not. Evangelical behavioral modification homes do not. Legalistic homes have no room for weird, bizarre, strange, goofy, quirky kids because they annoy us and they embarrass us. You send a little boy out in the backyard to play. What does he do? He does a headbutt into a tree. Boom! And he hits it. And you say, what is wrong with you? And then he hits into the rock. And they say, what are you doing? They're little boys. They do headbutts. You have a little girl. Even if you only have one little girl, she's never alone. She has imaginary friends. They have names. You give her a collection of 5 stones. She'll make a family. Here's the mother. Here's their names. You give her Barbie dolls. What she do? She plays The View. She set them up there and they debate something. And here's Whoopi over here. And here's the little conservative girl over here. And here's the redhead in the middle ticking everybody off. And her little brother comes in, sees a Barbie doll. What's he do? He picks it up, bites the head off, throws it like a grenade, makes explosive sound. That's little boys. They're weird. Teenage son goes over to his friend's house. Says, I'm thinking about a new hairdo. I'll help you. Lie face down in the grass. He gets down there. And the guy gets out the dad's weed eater. You know, and then they go in, get in mother's medicine cabinet, get out the L'Oreal, and they pour it all into one big thing and kind of put it in there and let it set a while and then rinse it out and then have a little bit of blue, a little bit of green, a little bit of pink, a little bit of yellow. Spikes it out, comes home, shows his mother's new hairdo. Walks in the kitchen. She's looking at him. She looks and she says, you know, I don't think Jesus would be very pleased with your hair. Isn't it interesting in desperation how fast we go for the heavy artillery? I don't think Jesus would be very pleased with your hair. It's not an uncommon thing to have out of performance-based parenting. And I remember there was a time when the kids' hair was more wild than it is right now. By the way, that style will be coming back in a few years. And I was refereeing a lot of fights between parents and kids, and I kept hearing the parents bring in the Bible, and this, Jesus is displeased. I don't think that presents yourself very well as a Christian, and on and on. So I thought, I wonder what the Bible has to say about hair. So that January, I put a little bookmark in there, keep your eye out for what God has to say about hair. I've read the entire Bible. And here's what God has to say about hair. He says, I don't care. It's your hair. Express yourself. Some of you might want to grab the opportunity while you can. Because it's going to bail on you. You say, what about that 2 Corinthians thing? It's a shame for men to have long hair. Always study the Bible in its context. That is not a thing about hair length. That's about covering of hair, covering of head for worship. And it wouldn't work today because men's hair back then was longer than most of the women I'm looking at right now, most of yours. No, he doesn't care. Now, can you have arbitrary rules about your kid's hair? Of course you can. You're the parents. You're the parent. You can make arbitrary rules about how they cut their hair. Just don't make it a moral issue because it's not. Don't make it a biblical issue because it's not. When we do that, we suck grace out of the room. In fact, we shove a wedge between their heart and ours and their heart and God's. If anything, do you know when you say something like you drop name, God's name for your selfish agenda, we're breaking one of the big 10, you know, the ones he etched in stone up on Sinai. Remember where he says, don't use my name in vain. Don't misapply my name to your selfish agenda. I don't appreciate that. That's not what my name's for. I have a son named Colt. He's our youngest. He's very tall, 6'4". But, and he grew tall even in junior high. And he asked me at the beginning of his seventh grade, "Dad, can I grow my hair long?" I said, "Sure, man, give it your best shot. You're gonna have to grow it very long for it to be as long as mine was when I was in seventh grade." He grew his hair real long, looked great. I was speaking at a church in Miami in the springtime. And in fact, I was done. I was in the taxi heading to the airport when my phone rang and it was Colt. He said, "Dad, it's spring break. I know we're gonna have a lot of fun." He said, "Dad, I was wondering, can I have a mohawk? Can I have a mohawk?" And I thought about it. I said, "Yeah, that'd be kind of fun. Tell you what, I'll be home tonight around 7 o'clock. I'll cut you a great mohawk. You can have it all week, but we'll have to buzz it off on Saturday because your school doesn't allow mohawks." He hung up the phone. His sister Shiloh was listening. He said, "What did Dad say?" He said, "I can have one. He's going to cut it for me when he gets home tonight." She said, "I know how to cut one of those." They got out the clippers. She cut him a mohawk. They took Elmer's glue and they glued that thing up. And he went to church. Now, I'm sure some people had to step up their meds. I mean, they were going through the bottom of their purse, just popping everything they could, wondering what happened to security. And I'm sure some people were saying, "Isn't that the son of the guy that writes the books on parenting?" I'm sure. But in between the two services, there was one man standing out there with some people who saw my son, and that was our senior pastor, Daryl. And he saw Colt at a distance, and he looked at him. "Colt Kimmel, is that you? Get over here. I got to see this." He came over and said, "That's the greatest mohawk I've ever seen. How do you get it to stay up like that?" "Glue." And he went, "I wish I had a camera to take a picture of me and Colt Kimmel from my study. Me and Colt Kimmel, this cool mohawk." Because you need to know something. We took our kids to a grace-based church every Sunday. We wanted to make sure our kids were in a church where the people running it know what matters and what doesn't matter. Man looks on the outside. God looks on the heart. He had a great heart. Daryl didn't care about the outside. You say, but Tim, yeah, but don't you think sometimes on the outside they're reflecting problems on the inside? Sure. Does it make any sense to go after the outside still? That's a symptom. If the problem's on the inside, deal with the heart. The outside will take care of itself. If there's not a problem in the heart, don't worry about the outside. Grace-based families give the people they love the freedom to be different. Secondly, they give them the freedom to be vulnerable. To be vulnerable. Meaning they don't have to wear masks. They can verbalize their doubts and their fears. Their weaknesses can come to the surface without fear of them being attacked. They're in safe harbor for their emotions inside that home. I was going into the ninth grade. There was a gymnasium on the second floor of a county building a couple blocks from the school. And I went in there one winter morning for phys ed. And as soon as I came in, I got very excited because there was a trampoline opened right in the middle of the gym. And the reason I got excited is because I'd never jumped on one before. They weren't pieces of equipment in backyards back then. Our PE coach came out. We all gathered around. He looked around at all of us. He came back to me and said, "Kimmel, take off your shoes, leave on your socks, climb up here and follow my instructions." So I pulled my shoes off and I climbed up. But as I did, I realized I had holes in both of my socks. Not one, both. And one of my friends thought everybody should notice this. He said, "Oh, look at Tim's toes. Isn't this sad? We need to take up a collection, buy Tim some real socks." Now, were that to happen to me now at my age, I could care less what people think about how I look. But when you're in that quarter of time, that 14, 15, 16, 17, that's a time when kids are unusually self-conscious. So this became a real embarrassing moment to me. It was like he was putting down my family's economics, which, by the way, we were lower middle class, meaning we paid our bills in time. We never missed a meal. But our big thing is get as much mileage out of your clothing as you can. And up to that point, I thought that was a good idea until I was up there jumping, doing exactly what the coach was telling me to do. All I was thinking about is my toes sticking out. When I stood down, my mind went, I said, "I'm going to go home. I'm going to get out my sock drawer. I'm going to darn every pair of socks. I will never let this happen to me again." The other guys jumped. The bell rang. The coach dismissed us. He took off. I got on my shoes, went over to the stage at the end, got on my coat and my books, grabbed my books, and I went out the side door and went down the stairs. I got to the bottom of the stairs, and I hear my name, "Kimmel, wait up." It was the coach. He came down, he pulled me aside, said, "Hey, Tim, I want to tell you why I called on you to do the demonstration. Tim, you're the most agile student in my class." And then he reached down and he pulled off his tennis shoe. He had a big old hole in his sock. He's standing there just wiggling his toes. Said, "You know, us agile guys are tough on socks." Now go to class. So I'm heading over to class. And the whole way I'm thinking, what's agile? Because I'd never heard the word before, which shows you what a pathetic student I was. But I was going to English class, and they had these big dictionaries on their own stand. They loved it when you actually looked it up a word on your own without a gun held to your head. So I went over, and I looked up agile. Now, I'm glad I didn't find argyle. That would have been so confused. But I found agile. And I read for the first time in my life that I could move with speed, ease, elegance, and liveliness. And I read for the first time in my life that I was mentally alert and quick-witted. I wrote it down. And I memorized it. And I did a 180-degree turn in two major areas of my life, academics and athletics, because I was agile. Now, it took me a while to put all the pieces together to figure out why the coach disappeared so quickly after class. He had to get to his little office off the gym, pull his shoe off, get the scissors out, cut the hole in it, in his sock, put the shoe back on, and chase me down. He didn't go around with holes in his socks. He got new equipment and socks as part of the deal. But he saw a vulnerable kid that needed help. And he touched his life with grace. Now, I want to say something to all you adults. Listen, our children and young people have these kind of moments all the time. Someone has described childhood as a 24-hour day, 7-day a week, 365-day-a-year battle to keep from being embarrassed. And they need to know that their hearts are safe in there, that we don't trivialize, marginalize the difficulties they're going through. And grace-based families give the people they love the freedom to be different, freedom to be vulnerable. Thirdly, they give them the freedom to be candid, meaning they can tell us what's on their heart, even if it's stuff we're not excited about hearing. Maybe they're starting to doubt their faith. They're questioning whether the Bible is reliable, that there's more than, they think that there might be one, more than one way to God than through Jesus. This is not a time to panic. This is not a time to hire a theology professor from Dallas Seminary and duct tape him to the face of your kid. Smarter kids than yours and mine have struggled and doubted these things. And what gets them through it is when they see the adults in their life maintaining a calm confidence in God and in their faith and living it out and showing grace to them, to those kids while their faith is on trial. You know, sometimes their frustration is with us. Because we get it wrong. We're imperfect parents. We make mistakes. Does your kid, or grandchild have an outlet to voice that to you? Say, well, why? I don't know whether I want to do that. Well, God does it with us. Like I said, I don't want to be a name dropper. But in Hebrews chapter 4, in verse 15, Jesus says, we don't have a high priest that doesn't understand what it's like to be in our skin, but was an always tempted like we are, yet without sin. Look at verse 16. He says, let us then approach the throne of grace with confidence so that we may receive mercy and find grace to help us in our time of need. That includes times when we come to God and we're frustrated with him or we're angry at him because sometimes things happen in our life and we just don't know, well, God, where were you? He's got a big chest. He says, come to me. You'll find my throne of grace will welcome you there as you work that through. Now, when your kids talk to you about frustrations they have with you, they have to do it respectfully. And the best way to make sure your kids speak respectfully to you when they're frustrated with you is speak respectfully to them when you're frustrated with them. Our son, Cody, he was a junior in high school. And he had finished his homework. It was in the springtime. And he finished his homework. And then he was going to bed. He said, oh, Dad, I forgot to mention. I need you to sign me out of school tomorrow. Said, why is that? Oh, because it's opening day of the Diamondbacks. And my friend Steven has tickets behind the dugout. He invited me to go with him. Me and Steven. He has an extra ticket. Now, you need to know something. The Arizona Diamondbacks had beaten the New York Yankees the year before in the World Series. So this is a big opening game. But for some stupid reason, I felt like I needed to teach my son about personal responsibility. I said, Cody, you're a student. You students go to school in the morning at 8 and you get home at 3. He said, yeah, but Dad, they're going to have F-16s fly over. Yeah, well, that would be fun. But you know, it's like you have a job. And we work till quitting time on jobs. That's how it works, son. And you can just see his countenance just falling. And he said, Dad, I think I think Alice Cooper's going to sing the national anthem. And he was so, and I came back, and then finally he got real quiet, but he spoke respectfully. He said, "Dad, listen, I bring you home straight A's. All I've ever brought you home are straight A's. I can't bring you home any better grades than I'm bringing you. Now you need to decide whether I can go to that game." It was like a little hand came right down out of the clouds from heaven and did one of these on, "What is your problem? Sign that kid out." And what's really ironic is me teaching my son about personal academic responsibility. Those straight A's didn't come from my side of the gene pool. They came from his mother's. I struggled in school for B's and C's. I felt like you should have vowels and consonants on your report card. I mean, look, Dad, we could play find a word. Look, I see like three. How many do you, you know? I reached in my pocket. I took out two large bills and I handed them to him. And I said, "Cody, make sure you buy the big hot dogs and drinks for you and Stephen. And Cody, please forgive me for being such an idiot." You know, the memories of youth fade as we get older. They just do. Most of what happened in our youth becomes a blur, a fog. And this event in Cody's life could well fade from his memory. But had I stood my ground and refused to sign him out, he would have never forgotten to the day he died what an idiot he got assigned for as a father. We get it wrong sometimes. They need to have an outlet so we can make it right. Your kids do not need perfect parents. They need imperfect, grace-based parents. Hebrews 12:15, "See to it that no one misses the grace of God, that no bitter root grows up to cause trouble and defile many." Grace-based families give the people they love the freedom to be different and vulnerable and candid. And lastly, grace-based families give the people they love the freedom to make mistakes, Now, I don't mean by this that we're encouraging the mistakes, but they're going to make them. And I'm not meaning by this that there aren't consequences, because discipline and correction are a form of grace. It places high value on someone to say, "I love you too much to stand idly by, do nothing while you're self-destructing. I'm going to discipline and correct you. I don't want you to waste all your potential. We're going to grow you up to make a difference." And part of that is consequences for the mistakes you made. But if home is where life is making up its mind, then it must be a place where disappointments are tolerated, hurts are endured, and mistakes never mean the end of a relationship. Where did I get these four things from? I got them from how Jesus deals with you and me. He gives you and me the freedom to be different and vulnerable and candid, and the freedom to make mistakes. And I close with this little story. And that is just a reminder that the window of opportunity to touch our kids with grace is not open as long as we think it is. They go through our lives faster than you can imagine. I was reminded of this one Saturday morning when my daughter Shiloh awakened me before dawn. She was about 4 or 5 years old, and she shook me awake, and she said, Dad, time to get up and go on our date. I'd promised her the night before I'd take her out on a breakfast date. And she had gotten up and gotten ready, and I looked at the clock and said, "Honey, it's still dark outside." "But Dad, I fixed my hair for you." It was all snarled. I picked this outfit out for you. It was mismatched. But I also knew where she wanted to go was open, because it's open every day of the year, 24 hours a day, Christmas. It was a convenience store called Circle K. They're all over Arizona. And I said, no problem. I got up, I got dressed. We got there right about dawn. And she picked out a couple of donuts and juice. I got a cup of coffee. I paid for everything. Then we went out and we sat on the curb on the side of the Circle K to have our date. And we're sitting over here, and there's a dumpster just over here. But we're over here, we're fine, and everything's fine over here. And we're visiting, and she wanted to talk about the Sleeping Beauty movie we had gotten for her that she'd seen several times. And she's talking away about Sleeping Beauty, and I'm listening. And I said, "Honey, what's your favorite part of that movie?" She said, "Dad, I love the part at the end when the handsome prince and Sleeping Beauty dance together in the castle." And I thought, that's my favorite part of that, because I'd seen it, and I don't know what provoked me to do it, but I decided to reenact it. I put everything back in the bags, lids on everything, and I picked Shiloh up, and I started singing this, "I know you, I waltzed with you once upon a dream. We were just waltzing away. As I came around, there was a little empty lot behind this thing, and right across some brand new homes. And I looked over there, and there was a guy just staring out. He's sitting in his kitchen table, and he's staring out at me. And I'm looking at him, and the thought crossed me. He's over there stirring his coffee, calling his wife. Quick, come here, look. There's an idiot over at the Circle K. Dancing with a little girl next to a dumpster. But another thought crossed my mind that in a very brief period of time, some young man was going to come along and tap me on the shoulder. He said, Mr. Kimmel, may I cut in and waltz that girl out of my life for good? Turned out his name is Ian. He's a wonderful young man. And it happened so fast. I mean, just in a blink of an eye. Listen, when it comes to parenting, the days are long, but the years are short.
I hope that presentation was as encouraging to you as it was to me, as we think through not just how to train our children in the faith, which is very, very important, but how to do so in a way that makes them want what we believe. And that's what this ministry is all about. If there's any way we can help you in that effort, any tools we can provide, we'd be glad to do so. Just get in touch. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.